social activists, a newspaper editor, and some other folks who were concerned about young girls who were being sold into prostitution. In 1885, because the age of consent was 13. So imagine a 13-year-old being given over, sold into prostitution, just a terrible thing. And so these people came together and wanted to try and get that law changed. So they were able to work together in a pretty incredible story and influence Parliament to change this law.
Welcome to the Challenging Evil podcast, brought to you by the Salvation Army's Caring Magazine. Turn good thoughts into good actions. Go to caringmagazine.org. From the dusty pages of Carvoso Gauntlet's book, Social Evils the Army Has Challenged, emerges our Challenging Evil podcast. We believe that this collection of staggering real-life stories of transformation will fire up our imaginations and convictions to fight for a better world today. What can you look forward to in Challenging Evil? Stories of social and spiritual transformation from the front lines of radical justice. Prepare yourself to be amazed.
Chapter 1 of Challenging Evil, The Maiden Tribute of Modern Babylon. This story is epic. It has so many incredible, mind-boggling details, actually. I'm going to give you a quick version of it, but then we're going to ask Joanne Shade, who's recently written a book called Eliza, the Midwife, that goes into sort of a different view, the women's view of how this whole thing unfolded. And she has, you know, access to court transcripts and original documents, and she knows some stuff. So we're really pleased to be able to interview her about the details of the story. And then we're going to talk to Priscilla Santos, who works at territorial headquarters here in Long Beach. Where they have recently launched a 10-year plan to combat trafficking. And we're going to get into the nitty-gritties of how we can continue the fight against human trafficking in today's society and in the world today. But the mind-boggling details of these stories, this story is really that. I'm not even exaggerating. Bramwell Booth, Florence Booth particularly, got right into helping women who had found themselves in urban poverty, in prostitution, in sexual exploitation. And she began to hear these stories and see just the injustice of these young girls who were not protected by the law because there was no law. The age of consent was 13. So these 13-year-old girls were being bought and sold in sexual servitude. And she saw it and she literally couldn't sleep at night. And she told Bramwell about it. Bramwell went and saw for himself and he saw it as well. And he just thought, this is it. Like, this is not okay. And keep in mind that the Salvation Army was a fairly new movement. It was a bit fragile in terms of how the public perceived them, although it was very strong in its evangelical zeal. But they also believed, and William would write a book in a couple of years after this called In Darkest England, The Way Out. We're going to talk about that in chapter 2. But Bramwell and the Booths really believed that salvation was not just something that happened to an individual person, although they believe that's true. It is something that happens to an individual person, but it's more than that. It's something that happens to a society. When God's kingdom comes, with it comes social change. And where the poor are seen and acknowledged, and where dignity and hope and freedom and truth and human rights come into play. And so they really could not. They felt like, as followers of Jesus, they couldn't just preach about a personal freedom while these girls were literally in slavery. And so they started a campaign, and it was called the Agitation Campaign, which I absolutely love, because the whole purpose of the campaign was to agitate the public and the government to change the laws to protect young girls from human sexual slavery. And so they partnered with William T. Stead at the Pall Mall Gazette, famous paper at the time. He went into an investigative journalist mode, and Bramwell joined him. Really trying to get the facts to the public. This is happening, and this is really happening. Meanwhile, Catherine really advocated with the Prime Minister and with the Queen and with sort of the upper echelons of society, trying to use her influence as a very prominent female evangelist at the time, woman speaker. And William, of course, mobilizing the Salvation Army to go door to door and collect petitions. And you'll hear in an interview with Joanne Shea just how effective that was, in a very new strategy, but a very effective strategy, which they then delivered to Parliament. You'll also hear how the Salvation Army organized public rallies. All the cadets in the Salvation Army would sell the Pall Mall Gazette, the featured stories of the sex trade and what was going on with young girls in England, and really agitated society. They had one public rally that Joanne Shade says is numbered over 200,000 people just at one rally. So think of the size of that in London, which was much smaller at that time. And so this was a campaign. It was multi-pronged. In the end, the crux of the campaign is that William T. Stead and Bramwell Booth arranged for a woman to go undercover in a brothel. So a Salvation Army woman goes undercover into a brothel to kind of gather information. Another woman who used to be a brothel owner but had been saved through the Salvation Army programs, she gets involved, and she is part of an investigative plot to show that a girl can be bought. And she buys a young girl. And that girl that's bought then becomes this sensation, in a sense, becomes the truth embodied. This is happening. We just did it to prove that it can happen. And this campaign was launched into the public sphere, and it changed the mind, not only of the public, but it also changed the mind of Parliament. And they passed a new law that protected girls and changed the age of consent to 16. So it protected a lot of young, vulnerable girls. And it was a very successful campaign, successful for the Salvation Army, successful for England. And there's some things that we can learn. So we're going to look into the story a little further with historian Joanne Shade, and we're going to hear some of the details of this. And then we're going to hear from Priscilla Santos, who's going to tell us about a contemporary version of fighting modern sex slavery and slavery in general in the world today through the Salvation Army. And what we're really praying and hoping for is it'll agitate you. We're hoping to disturb your peace in the hopes that we might actually continue to fight for justice. Hang on and stick around. So, Joanne Shade, you are with us in the studio, as it were, and we're talking about the maiden tribute of modern Babylon, this historical epic story of early Salvation Army adventurous justice work. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it ended up being a coalition of people, which the Salvation Army was involved in, but also some other social activists, a newspaper editor, and some other folks who were concerned about young girls who were being sold into prostitution. And this was actually a semi-legal thing in 1885, because the age of consent was 13. So imagine a 13-year-old being given over, sold into prostitution, just a terrible thing. And so these people came together and wanted to try and get that law changed. So they were able to work together in a pretty incredible story and influence Parliament to change this law. That's, I guess, in a nutshell, what happened.
Yeah, and then in so doing, we're able to protect vulnerable girls primarily from being trafficked, yes, basically sex trafficked in London.
Yes. And they were not just doing it in London. They were often taking these girls and even shipping them over to Europe, 13, 14-year-old girls. And there wasn't anything the law could do because the age of consent was 13.
Now, this is even pre-Salvation Army in many respects, isn't it? It's right on the cusp of when the Salvation Army was formed.
Well, it was 1885 is when kind of these different actions went on. So, yes, it was Salvation Army would have been around about 20 years, but with its name only about 5 or 6. So it was really just beginning to come into its own and having some kind of presence within London. And so I'm thinking, from my perspective, it was a pretty big risk for the Salvation Army to take if not the lead, certainly a very strong role in this particular case.
Right. Now, Josephine Butler was the lead, wasn't it, on the whole campaign for years and years.
She was involved because this was important to her. She had some pretty fascinating involvement with trying to protect prostitutes as far as their health and keep them from being jailed in certain situations. Really, really concerned for what they would have at that point in time called fallen women. So Josephine Butler was involved. The newspaper editor, W.T. Stead, was instrumental in this through the Pall Mall Gazette, which was his newspaper. And the Booth family in particular, not so much William and Catherine, the leaders, the parents, but their son and daughter-in-law, Bramwell and Florence, were very involved in this happening, in this way of moving society, moving culture.
Yeah, and this is really a fun thing, because I understand, at least, you know, what I've read of the story, that Florence was so kind of like brokenhearted about what she was seeing in the downtown, like she was meeting some of these women and hearing their stories, and just couldn't be consoled almost.
Yes. Well, what happened with her was she and Bramwell had not been married very long, and had said, you know, each person was being given a job to do. And so she was given a position of leading a home for fallen women. And she had come from a much more, a higher class family. Yeah,
like an
and
upper
this was all so
family.
Very new to her.
Right.
But she really took this to heart. And so was leaving her home, sometimes with a baby in arms, traveling to this home where they had these women under their care, and just being heartbroken over what she saw and the stories she heard, and began then to share this. If she would come home and talk to her husband and tell him about it, you know, certainly telling her in-laws about it and saying, look what's happening here.
That's a really important part of the story, because a lot of times our ability to not intervene in injustice is because of our lack of proximity to it. Mm-hmm. And so the proximity she had, the close-up view, broke her heart. And then she told Bramwell. Bramwell basically didn't believe her, it would seem,
right,
in some of the accounts. So he was like, that can't, she must be exaggerating the point. So he went down to see for himself.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a description of an incident where a young woman came even to the headquarters at that point in time and talked to Bramwell about this story. So what I found interesting was that here was a situation where Butler with her ideas, the newspaper editor with his interest, and then the Booths, it all converged. It all came together at one time for them to say, okay, enough is enough. We need to change this.
Yeah, something must be done. So there was a commitment of there was a total commitment of their involvement.
And the law had been, it had been up for a vote quite a while, but they weren't willing to address it until finally these forces came together and said, we need this changed.
Now, the Salvation Army then became sort of shifted from compassion to strategic justice work. And this is what's fascinating to me, is the plan. I mean, it is a crazy, crazy plan. So they go from, and actually we should just clarify that, you know, Florence went to the home, heard the stories, broke her heart. She came back. She told Bramwell. Bramwell went to see for himself, and indeed he found it true. He couldn't believe it. And then these forces converged. The Salvation Army saw an opportunity in partnering with these other people. Mm-hmm. And then they made this commitment, which meant they became strategic about how they were going to go about this project. And this is where it gets really crazy, because already it's crazy, but this is where it gets really crazy. And we should say the straw that broke the camel's back for Bramwell's involvement was when a young girl escaped a brothel because she had a psalm book with the address of headquarters in it. Am I telling the truth right here?
Well, yes, that's one of the pieces. The idea that I think she had come from the countryside, and I think the story was that her mother said, if you ever get in trouble, this is who you should get involved. You know, this is who you should get in touch with. So she did. So that was one of the pieces that began to put this into play, that she was able to come and say, I need help.
Right. I have nowhere else to go. My mom told me to come here. And then they realized, okay, this is systemic. This isn't just one or two sad stories. This is systemic. And I think it's also really important to know, like, we think that the fight against human trafficking is some new modern thing, but this is human trafficking 150 plus years ago. Yeah. I mean, this is some our first work, you know, within the first 5 years of the Salvation Army's work, we were fighting human trafficking.
That's right. That's right. We may not have called it that.
Right.
But that's exactly what we were doing.
Now, tell me about this plan, because I read it and parts of me wants to laugh, part of me wants to cry. It's just so outrageous. Like, tell me the plan details.
Well, my guess is that the plan kind of evolved over time. So the first part of it was that the newspaper editor was planning to do a series of articles in the newspaper about what's going on here in London. And that's the Maiden Tribute of Modern Babylon was the title that he gave to this. And what he realized was that he could not write this without finding more information. So kind of the first step was that he and a couple of the other people from the newspaper decided to go undercover into the underworld of London and see for themselves. And so they visited bars, they visited brothels, they spoke with police officers in that time, and they began to hear the stories for themselves. They began to see what was out there for themselves. So that was piece number one.
Investigative journalism, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, there was a second part to that investigative journalism that this one blows me away, because somehow a young Salvation Army woman, she's only given a pseudonym, so I could not find out who she was. But there is enough in the historical record to say that this happened. She actually went undercover into a brothel as a prostitute and was there 9 days, seeing what was going on, reporting back each day. She did it by telling the madam that she had a very good customer, a very well-paying customer who was, if she was seeing anybody else, that he would quit. So that apparently worked.
And they gave her money, isn't it? But it's very sketchy.
Right. So W.T. Stead came each night,
okay,
visited with her, gave her money. She would give the money to the madam. That's how they pulled off this plan.
Wow.
But she was discovered, like, toward the end of the 9 days, she was discovered, and there were plans to send her to the continent with some other young women. She caught wind of it, sent a note to her fiance. He came rushing to the rescue. She ended up jumping out the second floor window, as best I could ascertain. Now, you remember this is over 100 years ago. There are some written records of that. To me, it was, wow, how could you even allow a young woman as part of your organization to do this? There were an awful lot of risks in this particular part of the plan. But I can kind of imagine, you know, a brave young woman saying, I'll do it. I'll go and prove, you know, I want to prove this. We certainly, hopefully would not ask someone in our day and age to do that. But it's part of the historical record that this young,
you know, it's interesting because part of the, like, I think of the early days of IJM in the fight against modern day trafficking with children, and they didn't ever send anybody as a victim undercover, but they sent them as a perpetrator undercover.
Wow.
And they still do, actually. They still send them in as buyers of children, and they record, they have secret recording devices on them, and they record evidence that then is used in the court, which is kind of what they're doing, except instead of a buyer, they're using a victim, which is itself I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
This episode of Challenging Evil is brought to you by Frontier Press, the Salvation Army's publishing arm that includes Joanne Shade's historic novel, Eliza and the Midwife. Go to frontierpress.org.
So we're here with Priscilla Santos. And Priscilla, welcome.
Thanks.
Glad to have you.
Happy to be here.
Great. You are the initiator for what's called Fight for Freedom, a 10-year plan to combat trafficking. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So Fight for Freedom is the Salvation Army's Western Territory 10-year plan to combat human trafficking. So human trafficking is something that we know that's happening all over on the other side of the world, but even here in our neighborhoods and our communities. And historically, the Salvation Army, we've done a phenomenal job of kind of tackling it. But now what we're really wanting to do is cast vision and a strategy on how to do it well, how to do it holistically, and how to do it in a way that brings the most dignity to the survivors of it.
That's great. And I guess, I mean, one of the things is that we've historically fought human trafficking even before we knew what it was called, like that it was called human trafficking.
Yeah, before that terminology even existed.
Right. We were busy doing it. But the way that trafficking happens now is different in many respects. So part of it is adapting our strategies to what fits for today.
Yeah. So one of the big like something that happens a lot now that we're seeing, especially here in the U.S., is something called mental slavery, where it's not necessarily that we see the survivors of trafficking anymore when we walk into a hotel room. If law enforcement are doing an investigation, they don't walk in and see a girl chained up to the bed or anything like that. What we're seeing is that it's more now mental coercion and mental slavery. So it's the idea of saying, if you leave, then we're going to go and kill your family. If we leave, then this is what's going to happen to you. So it's kind of that idea where they stay in that situation.
Right.
It's changing.
So the slavery isn't as overt.
Exactly.
It's more subtle. So it's actually harder to fight in some respects.
Exactly. That's why it's a lot harder to fight and to find and to help.
And that might be actually a lot of people say to me all the time, like, I don't understand. Why don't people just leave if you're not actually chained up? And that's part of the plan to fight human trafficking.
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I actually feel very privileged because I think you get a lot of insight when you're in this field, when you've worked with the survivors. But until that's happened, it's kind of hard to know.
Hard to understand.
Yeah, exactly.
So you went from, you used to actually manage Survivor Services Recovery in Orange County for the Salvation Army.
Yeah, I was the program coordinator for the Salvation Army's Anti-Trafficking Services Program, which is an OC. We have a safe house, and we also provide holistic services for trafficking individuals, men, women, children of all ages.
And you also headed up a task force?
Yeah, so we were also on the board for the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force, kind of creating vision and creating a whole countywide collaboration to really approach this, because it's something that we believe that we can't really do it alone, which is also part of our plan. We need everybody's strengths and everybody's skills on the table to really fight this.
Okay. So there's a plan. That's like number one. There's a plan. There's a way. So instead of being paralyzed, overwhelmed, immobilized, which is often when people hear the realities of trafficking, sometimes they just switch off because it's too hard. They put it in that basket that's just like, I'm not professional enough. I don't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, no. Let's get out of the overwhelmed basket, out of the too hard basket. And this is possible. Everyone's invited. And what is the plan?
Yeah. If you have breath, you could do something about it.
Okay, guys, if you're breathing, which some of you might need to check, but if you're breathing, you can join the fight.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're breathing, so you are invited.
What's the plan? Tell us. How are we going to do it?
Yeah, so the plan is actually, here's the strategy. So it's together with all of our core ministries, which is our churches, with our territorial program, so to provide that type of support, and all of our social services throughout the territory, and all really focusing on four major pillars and areas of focus. And those areas of focus are, the first one is awareness and training.
Right.
The second one is prevention and outreach. The third one is survivor services and recovery. And then the last one is partnerships and advocacy. So it's really having all of these different areas being our focus to move forward as a strategy.
Great. So these are the foundational pillars of the plan. So, and just for the record, this is like all hands on deck in terms of a Salvation Army. Like this is the Salvation Army's fight against trafficking, and this part of the Western states at least is saying this is our strategy. But we also want to make it really clear that everybody's invited, even if you're not part of the Salvation Army, you're invited to participate with this as well, right?
Totally.
Okay, so awareness and training, pillar number one. Talk to me. How do people do that? How do you get trained? You know, what do you do?
Yeah, so awareness and training, we believe, is probably the first one, and it's going to be the major one that we focus on, at least for the first year, because we believe that without being aware that it's happening, nothing's going to move forward. But once you're aware, which a lot of people are aware to a certain degree now, you have to be properly trained to know what to do. So throughout the territory, we're hosting different training days. So if that's something that you're interested in, please reach out to us on sajustice.us and ask us to come and host a training. There's also different task forces all around the territories that you could just join, and there's constantly trainings that you could be a part of and
webinars,
sign up for.
Webinars online.
Yeah, we're doing webinars right now every other month, so that's something that you could also find out some more information on our website as well.
Fantastic. So what it is and then what to do if you see it, those are kind of the key awareness issues. And this is, you know, there's been a bunch of stories in the news lately, but I have an actual friend who went to an awareness training seminar on trafficking and then got on a flight back to Africa. And while she was on her flight back to Africa, she saw an older gentleman with a younger girl, and it looked awkward. It looked weird. The younger girl didn't seem like she was free for movement. Whenever she went to the bathroom, the guy would stand outside the bathroom. There were just all these red flags she saw. She talked to the flight attendant and said, you know, I just took this seminar. I'm seeing this thing happen, and I don't want to be paranoid, but do you see it too? And the flight attendant was like, I see it too, and phoned ahead. And when the plane landed, they had police at the plane and stopped them, and she was being trafficked.
Yeah.
So like one awareness training seminar, and just was like, I just spotted trafficking and I just stopped someone from being trafficked just because you're made aware and you know what to do.
Yeah. Being educated is essential. And even when working with survivors, they'll tell you that the trafficker could take everything away from them, but they can't take away their education. So right. It's really this holistic view that just being aware, being trained well, being educated on the issue really is essential.
So this is awareness training for people who don't know anything at all about it. And it's also training for people who are in vulnerable spots.
Yeah.
And things like that. So you know what to do if something were to happen, if you're exploited, if something happens. So we're working on strategies around that too.
Yeah. So definitely focusing on doing more awareness and trainings in areas of where people are vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the sex trafficking nowadays is occurring in hotels. So making sure that we're doing training for the housekeepers in addition to the managers as well, right? So kind of inviting them to be alongside of us. Working with the ethnic group community centers in our counties and in our cities so they could be aware, because they're the ones really interacting on a day-to-day level with the people that are most vulnerable. So making sure that they have the tools that they need to know how to identify it and talk to other people on what to do of it if they see it.
Right. And also all our frontline workers. So if you're at a church, in a community, which is every church, if you're in a shelter, you're like a homeless shelter provider or domestic violence or whatever it is, you're frontline people. You're the ones that are seeing vulnerable people and signs of trafficking. You might not even know it.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure everyone's trained. Okay, that's pillar number one. Pillar number two.
Pillar number two is prevention and outreach. So we do think that there are strategic ways to prevent human trafficking. And one of our really big initiatives is called Brave. And Brave is actually a catalytic event dedicated to foster girls that churches could kind of host for them. So that's something that we're really excited about. We have all of that information up on our website as well. So if you are listening and you are a part of a church, you could go to our website and sign up to get some more information on there as well. And statistically speaking, over 70% of the sex trafficking victims in the U.S. right now are actually coming out of the foster care system. So the idea behind Brave is, if the traffickers are reaching them, why is it that we, as the church and people of faith, can't reach them beforehand?
Yeah, I think this is like staggeringly amazing. It's some of the first really optimistic news around the idea of ending trafficking. I mean, because, you know, sometimes we just think like, what? It is so massive. But if you can think of preventing 70 to 80% of domestic sex trafficking in America, that's a pretty big blow to sex traffickers. Totally. If we could get to their vulnerable people before they do and prevent them, that's 70 to 80%. I mean, that's literally, that's then we only have to take care of 20% more, mm-hmm. right? Like in sex trafficking. So it kind of seems like it's a conceivable possibility. It's super cool. Great. Also, places like letting guys know at sex shows. There's a booth that goes out to some sex shows just to educate people that might actually see trafficking and not be even aware of what they're participating in. You know, we've talked to tons of victims who asked for help from their so-called Johns. Yeah. And the Johns were terrified, so they ran away and never helped them. So we're even educating people, even though morally we disagree with their behavior, we're trying to say on a justice level, you could at least call a hotline when you leave and say, like, I think I spotted something that didn't feel right.
You're actually the eyes and ears on the ground.
Yeah, you're also the problem, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
And you know, part of human trafficking is also labor trafficking, which is something that's happening enormously, and it's even more hidden, in my opinion. So that's a big area of concentration as well for us in terms of prevention. And one of the things that we are already doing is that we're serving a lot of the migrant community, and there's so much labor exploitation and trafficking happening there. So really training our migrant workers to know what to do, to know that either if it's labor trafficking or labor exploitation, it's against the law, and there's actually there's services for these individuals that it's happening to.
Right.
Yeah. So that's another big area.
And pay attention for that, because we'll be working more and more and more in that area. Prevention and outreach. Pillar number three.
Yeah, pillar number three is survivor services and recovery. So this is an area that currently we are strongest in, I believe, and something that I really think the Salvation Army in particular really has a unique strength about, which is being able to serve somebody holistically with the proper support. One of the things that I heard all the time in OC was that the survivors, they're just lonely, right? They're here without a family. They don't have anybody to turn to. Our social services program, you know, they have a lot of limitations. So really, if you wanted to help them build into any type of community or help them feel like they belong, we have the perfect thing, which is called the CORS, right? It's already a part of our DNA. It's already a part of us. So the idea for the Survivor Services and Recovery is to be able to expand on having dedicated shelter beds for trafficking survivors, but also connecting them to the right holistic resources that's needed, right? So that's whether that's immigration relief or legal assistance or getting connected to social services, getting connected to a mental health therapist, or even like celebrating their birthday and making them feel like they're known and they're a part of us now. Like we have a family for them that they could be a part of.
Yeah, and there's some beautiful, I think because partly your experience and best practice models is really the Salvation Army trying to maintain a best practice model of victim-centered, survivor-centered recovery services, where we're not just saying, you know, you need a bed for tonight. Well, we've got you. It's not an emergency basis. This is like we're actually going to partner with you from the first time we meet, which is maybe shortly after you've exited a trafficking situation, and we're going to see you all the way till you're in an independent situation, and then ideally able to help some more people. So it's this holistic long-term approach.
Yeah. So it's really this idea of walking alongside the survivor as they are exiting their trafficking situation, hopefully to sufficiency and then all the way to thriving, right?
Yeah.
And really one of the key components there is also having the ability to work. So this is actually a big part of this pillar and this focus as well, is creating more job opportunities for them.
Right.
Because if you talk to any of them, their number one request is going to be, I just want to work.
Yes.
And it's complicated.
Which is what got them exploited in the beginning.
Exactly. Poverty. Yeah.
So so that's kind of key. And our aim is to have a safe survivor services recovery in every state of our territory, so in the 13 western states of America, at the very least. Yeah. In many of those states, especially with big cities like Los Angeles, could use a lot more than that. But our basic aim is to start a safe house with a survivor services recovery best practice model in every state. So if you're listening to this and your state doesn't have one, please contact us at sajustice.us and we'll start that prayer team and conversation and dream about that being a reality.
Yeah, and if you want to know currently where we do have safe houses too, we have that information also up on our website with a fun little interactive map that has the contact information that you could call. So check that out as well.
Yeah, because what those safe houses need are lots of volunteers. That's the other thing. So if you're looking, if you're in and you're near one, you could become a volunteer and it would help that practice big time. Okay, the final pillar.
The big finale. Which is actually probably one of my favorites, is partnerships and advocacy. So again, it's this idea that although the Salvation Army is extremely strong and we've been pioneering this since our beginning, we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. We need everybody's strength at the table. And what that means is really working alongside other NGOs, other churches, other even businesses. And one of the ways that that's become a reality here in the U.S. is through task forces. So ideally, every city has a human trafficking task force that you could join. So that's one of our big efforts, is to say, hey, if you don't know where to start, a perfect place to start is just to attend your general task force meeting and to see what's happening and to ask the question like, hey, where can I fill in the gap?
You know, one of the great observations we made when we were making this new podcast called Challenging Evil is the first campaign to combat human trafficking of young girls in London, England, called the Maiden Tribute Affair. It was a collaboration right from the start. So even the idea that the Salvation Army was battling this by itself, even from the very beginning, is not true. The Salvation Army has always been a partner in the fight against human trafficking. And our best work and everyone's best work is going to be a collaboration where everybody brings their best efforts together and we fight this thing as a whole.
Yeah.
So we're looking for partners. If you're looking for partners, we are too.
Yeah.
We'll be good friends.
And we really want to be good partners as well.
Yes. We want to do the most good. Okay, thanks, Priscilla.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much.
For more information on the fight for freedom, go to sajustice.us. To download original chapters and a new discussion guide, visit caringmagazine.org. Challenging Evil podcast is created by SA Justice, hosted by Danielle Strickland, and engineered by Saul Sosa.